Welcome to Story and Horse, a podcast where we hear stories from creative lives. Meet new people, hear about their challenges and triumphs, and get inspired to move forward with your creativity. Now here's your host, Hillary Adams.
Hello, thanks for joining us here on the Story and Horse podcast. I'm Hillary Adams, founder of Story and Horse. We offer personalized coaching for creative people. And here on the podcast, we share stories from creative lives. Today, we are joined by Menon Dwarka. Menon is a cultural worker and consultant. Welcome, Menon.
Hey, how are you?
Let's begin with a little bit about who you are and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're up to.
Well, who I am is often complicated. But I'll do my best to put it succinctly. I mean, I'm somebody who trained as a composer and has been working in the cultural arts for the majority of my adult life. But I am somebody who has a fairly complicated, ethnic background or a cultural background. I was born in South America in Guyana. In a South Asian community there, and came to Canada when I was 6 months old. And then I went to grad school around 25 in New York City and stayed there for about 18 years and then came back to Toronto after my mother got sick and passed away. I'm the oldest son of a Hindu family. So when that happened, it was kind of my duty to return back and look after my father. And it's been a good choice in doing that. Lots of other things in my life came together with my return to Canada. But if you were to ask me if I'm South Asian, I'd say yes. If you were to ask me if I'm Guyanese, I'd say yes. If you asked me if I'm Canadian, I'd say yes. Asked me if I was a New Yorker, I'd say yes. So all of that stuff is part of me. And yet I don't think any of it specifically defines who I am. And I think a lot of that has helped me become a cultural thinker and an artist that is very comfortable and adept at crossing boundaries and thinking through problems.
Hmm. And tell us a little bit about the cultural work that you are doing.
Well, again, it's, my life, I think, is always just, these things come by happenstance, right? I mean, I went to New York to do grad school and as a composer, and then I ended up writing music for 5 years for TV. And then I, after 9/11 and a writer's strike and kind of restructuring of that whole business, I became involved in community arts education. And I just started realizing that the kind of inventive, on-the-spot, improvisational problem-solving that I was called upon to do in the commercial music writing world, that seemed to be very handy in running a music school or an arts department. And so after I kind of stopped doing commercial music writing, I've basically been problem-solving on many different levels for cultural institutions. And I didn't realize until very recently that in itself was a job. I've been an executive director for a long time. But, at the heart of those things is the, building audiences, raising money, creating community. And what I realized is that while I liked those things and were good about those things, I was fairly agnostic about who I would be doing it for. And so, with COVID and some other things changing the cultural landscape, that I found out that there is demand for my skills outside of a specific job. And in a way, for me, it was a more ideal space to be in because the kind of internal politics of a position, as well as dealing with specific staff challenges and whatnot, that I was less interested in dealing with those things than with figuring out how an organization should function at a more kind of primal, fundamental level, or figuring out how to deal with equity, diversity issues within a particular community. It's something that I do a lot of thinking through and work with organizations about, the fact that there isn't a kind of blanket equity, diversity, and inclusion solution. It's that, you know, well, where are you located? What are the demographics there? And does your artwork in a way make the people who are, you know, to a large extent, subsidizing your work, are they able to access that work? Or are they able to see themselves in that work? So for me, that's the kind of, I've been working with organizations, you know, huge ones and very tiny ones. And, you know, I'm working right now with a group called Workman Arts here in Toronto, which is an organization that serves for lack of a better word, and this is a term that they use themselves, the MAD community here, the artists with mental illness, and figuring out how those organizations can serve that community in a more resource-conscious and holistic way, so that they're not trying to solve all problems, but that they're solving problems that will really help artists move their work forward who have those particular challenges. So basically, you know, if you have a problem and you need someone who's creative to think through what might be there, I parachute in, get the lay of the land, and we work on it and figure out a solution together. And then I move on to the next town, you know. Not exactly like the old Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk, but not that different either.
You were saying that the inventive on the spot problem solving that you had originally developed, I think through the music work that you've mm-hmm. been, that's been very helpful as you've done this cultural work mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's something that I didn't do during my whole academic career. You know, I was able to have the luxury of taking a year and sometimes more than that to write a single piece, maybe some small pieces here and there, but bigger pieces would take a year or more. And everything was methodical. Everything was theoretically correct and structurally sound. But when I got to writing music for TV, you know, there was, you know, literally, hey, kid, here's a bunch of equipment. Here are the manuals. We don't have time to teach you any of this. And you'll be competing against us for these spots. So, and then the first one's due tomorrow. So good luck. And so that process, which, you know, many people, you know, when I joined that commercial music world, they thought, oh, isn't it a shame? Look at Menon. He's left serious music and gone off to write jingles or whatever for TV. But in fact, the musicians that I worked there were of super high caliber. And it's the fact that you had to write at the very tips of your consciousness, that you had to come up with solutions and, you know, not just think of the melodies and the harmonies, but, you know, program them in the computer and sync them with a photo, you know, film, and then sometimes sync live musicians as well too. You had to do all that in a fairly short amount of time, sometimes a day. If it was 2 days or so, that would be a luxury. But it was a space in which all that training and all of the hopes and desires of my younger self to like actually produce work became real, because under that pressure cooker, I just had to produce, right? So, and I think after 5 years of doing that, it just became the way my mind worked after that. So I don't have, there are people who can do many things very well, but I know one thing I can do is that if you tell me about a problem, that a solution is at hand quite easily for me shortly thereafter. I'm not sure where that comes from or why it's there, but I do know that it seems to be something I've been able to count on for most of my life.
Thank you. That's absolutely fascinating. The fact we've heard before on this podcast about people talking about how boundaries and sort of scaffolding around creativity sort of increases that pressure. And that's what you were just talking about, how you might have the luxury of 2 days, but often it was one day that you had to put all of this together. Yeah.
Well, I remember very specifically a friend of mine from school who heard a particular jingle I had written, and she said, oh, isn't this amazing? You've taken this theme and it, you know, done this with this, and it's backwards here, and there's this left turn or whatever. And I said, that's amazing that you can discern any of that, because I had no idea. And it was just trying to finish it. You know, I was just trying to, because it's unlike academia, you know, that world was you write your piece, you put it on a DAT tape, it goes in an envelope to the advertising agency, they blind pick it, and if they pick you, then you get paid, and if they don't pick you, you don't get anything. So it was a white hot just survival of like, if I don't slam dunk this, it's another day of worry to figure out how I'm going to make my bills at the end of the month. But the good thing is if you won something, it could carry, it would be a normal salary for somebody else, right? For a year. So you knew that if you hit occasionally, you could be okay. And if you hit often, like the guys I worked for, I mean, they all did very, very well during that space, but it was either you get this or it's a complete bust. Really made me frame my thinking in a particular way.
Hmm. Speaking of creativity, is there a story that you'd like to share?
Well, there is a story, I think, that it's not about creativity per se, but it's about a creative individual's openness and kindness, which is that maybe two people's. I should expand this out. So, I'm not sure why. I explained my background a little earlier, but for some reason, as a very young teenager, I got steered into classical contemporary music, which certainly was an odd thing for a teenager, but even more odd for someone who looked like me and came from the part of the world that I came from. But I had a high school music teacher who was really kind and supportive and thoughtful. And she actually very not self-consciously encouraged me to write without me knowing how difficult it was or how odd it was for me to be writing music. She just, would say, hey, why don't you try writing something for these instruments in the band? And that was great. But what was even better is that she was aware of what was going on in Toronto in terms of contemporary music, and would take me to shows and take me to performances. And one day she said, oh, John Cage is coming to Toronto. Do you want to go with me? And I, and here was, John Cage is this icon of contemporary classical music. And I had just been reading some of his books in our school library, for whatever reason, had a couple of his books. So here's this guy who was this absolute, historical figure in contemporary music, was coming to town, and I was going to go the show and see him, thanks to my teacher. So we went, and it was incredible, because at the beginning of the show, when he was getting this illustrious introduction, he kept sticking his head out from behind the curtains to look at the audience, and everyone was kind of giggling and laughing, and he was very ebullient and entertaining. But what was really incredible, that at intermission, I remember I immediately kind of went out into the foyer area, and he was just standing there, and nobody else had come out yet. So I ran up to him, and I started asking him this question, and he put his hand up right in front of me as I was literally kind of running towards him, which really caught me off guard. And then he lowered his hands, and he said, my name is John Cage. What's yours? And I said, I'm Menon Dvorka. And he said, Menon, are you a composer? I said, I'm just starting, and I don't know, I was 14 or 13, something like that. And he said, so we're just two composers talking. So he immediately understood the dynamic was there, and he completely flattened the landscape between the two of us. He just said, this is my name. What's your name? We're both doing the same thing. And then he said, did you have a question? And I said, yes. And I don't know, again, it's such a weird question for a kid to be asking, but and I probably just couldn't even think of a good question. So I said, which edition of the I Ching do you use when you write? And that was a Chinese book of change that he used in his composing. He would ask this oracle a question, and he'd throw some bamboo sticks on the ground and would discern a pentagram from that picture, and then figure out what the answer to his question by consulting this book. So I don't know why I knew about this book or anything, but I asked him which edition he used. And he started giving me this answer. And he said, oh, that's an interesting question. And he started answering. And then I started thinking about, oh my God, I'm looking at this guy. I'm looking right into his eyes. He was a student of Arnold Schoenberg, the guy who kind of helped pave the way for atonal classical music. He was had a strong friendship with French composer Pierre Boulez when the two of them were very young. I started going through all of this historical stuff that I knew about the guy. And before I knew it, the next thing I heard was, and that's the edition of the I Ching that I used. And I realized, oh my goodness, I totally didn't hear anything that he just said. And at that point, the guys who had brought him to Toronto came up to him because obviously they had donors and funders and other important people who they needed him to meet. And they grabbed him by the elbows and started, whisking him away. And he immediately knew what happened, because I'm sure this is something that he had witnessed many times in his career. So he just turned back to me and he said, just write John Cage, New York. It'll get to me. And I did, and it did. And we were able to continue that conversation. And for me, it was a life-changing experience for me, because not only did it feel like I could be part of a world of ideas and history and culture that I wouldn't have thought up of growing up in the suburbs of Toronto, but this other human being who is this titanic presence in the world demonstrated to me that he could fully see me as a human being. And I think for me, that started a role, a kind of self-acceptance that I think most teenagers kind of have to figure out how to traverse. And so even though it's not directly connected to my own cultural work as a composer or as a writer or someone who makes art of various kinds, that kind of recognition of myself as a fully fledged, worthy human being, and also someone who could be part of this world, it comes exactly from that moment in my life. So if there's something that I have learned from being in that space and being connected to that, is that sometimes the way that you can most encourage and bring forward someone else's confidence and belief in themselves is to just simply see them as another human being, which in no uncertain terms, John Cage did for me in that moment. He just literally made me feel like he and I occupied the same space. And in many ways, my musical work, and certainly even now in my equity, diversity, and inclusion work, it's a heartbeat away from that moment. That moment is present in almost all of my work and in all of my in my life. And it probably doesn't hurt that my parents, who were very much ideologically geared in the anti-colonialist movements that helped free millions of people around the planet, the idea that their son could be a force to bring in that kind of belongingness to people, I think that's a story that if not defines me, certainly guides me, has guided me along my path for several decades now.
Thank you. I want to sit with that there's so much richness in that story.
I'm glad to share it, because it's not often that I get a chance to tell that story. But I think part of it is too, Hillary, is that if I had been under the impression that beauty and intelligence and creativity and artistry came from a certain kind of person, the narratives I would have been provided with as a very young person would have counted me out of any of those spaces. And yet, I growing up here in Canada, I had one of my mother's aunts was here, who essentially functioned like my grandmother. And she's one of the kindest, nicest, best people I have ever met, but not able to read or write. And so if I have someone like her in my life who I valued really greatly, and as well as someone like this encounter with John Cage and all kinds of people in between, I mean, the overriding narrative I've been dealing with is that there's no way to predict where this kind of essential human light or essence or whatever you want to call it, where it's going to come from or where it's going to emanate from or where it's going to pull us forward. So if I didn't want people to do that to me, I think the best defense against that was to always foreground that, right? So, and you know, the truth is too, my mom was an extremely socially adept person and had, you know, when she passed away, there were literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people at her funeral, and people came from all over this hemisphere to be there. So, you know, I was modeled that a certain way, but I really believe it's, you know, I don't do it for some kind of altruistic goodness. In a funny way, it's that I'm aware of my own, the vibrational level or whatever you want to call it that I like to move at. And I can only really do that if I'm in harmony with somebody else that's with me. So my goal is always whenever I talk to someone is to find some kind of connection like that so I can be myself and hopefully they can be themselves too. And maybe in that honesty and truth, if we're artistically inclined or not, we can make some beautiful stuff, even if that beautiful thing is only our conversation. But maybe it's a story that we take away and fashion in some other medium or whatever it is, right? So it's despite me having a very long trajectory of training as an artist and composer, if you don't have that human element to you, then what are you doing, right? So it seems like you could be doing lots of other stuff. You could be an engineer if you wanted to build something perfect, or build something at least that you could hang your hat on as just working as a marker of goodness. But I think there's more interesting and more important things to be seeking.
And I have to ask, can you share which version of the I Ching Cage was using?
I can't, because I think in my other conversations with him, I didn't ask that again.
Oh,
I
no.
I didn't ask it again. So it's just like, I think it was a, you know what it is too? I think if there's a humility smack that ever happened to me, I'm pretty sure that in that moment of flustering to figure out what to ask him when he asked me if I had a question, is I was probably being a little performatively showing off for him that I knew what this book was, and wouldn't he think I was a clever boy? And so maybe the universe took that away from me in terms of, it's funny, Hillary, I never thought about the fact that I never got an answer to that question until now.
What a beautiful story. Manon, is there anything that you're up to now that you'd like to promote or share with our listeners, tell our listeners about?
I think that the only thing that is really, you know, for me, that's really important to share is that, you know, this work that I'm doing with the Arts Consulting Group. And for me, why that's important, I mean, like many people, I'm still writing music. I'm still writing articles. And there's some articles that I've written that are published at the Arts Consulting Group. But really, you know, what we were talking about earlier about that connection between people and solving problems, like that, those two things that I highlighted earlier are both present in the kind of work that I'm doing. And I know that oftentimes, you know, suit jacket wearing, you know, jet set consultants are kind of like thought of as, you know, hired guns to solve very mechanical problems. But, you know, in this pandemic time, and hopefully in this soon to be post-pandemic time, the idea of how we kind of psychologically move through these periods and how we figure out what new audience models are like and how we disseminate the work that we do. I'm really interested to collaborate with people and figuring out how, with the resources we have and the tools that we have at hand, how do we invent this next step for our sector? Because it's fairly clear to me there's a number of large organizations and not so large organizations that have benefited from the status quo pre-pandemic and are prepared to sail off the edge of the earth without adapting, and a lot of energy amongst younger artists and maybe established organizations with younger, more nimble management that want to think through new models. That I'm really, really curious to collaborate with people and figure out how to do that. I mean, I'll just remind everyone that even a podcast like this is a model of how there isn't a shortage of cultural engagement that's going on. In fact, there's more books and podcasts and videos and movies and records than we could ever imbibe in several lifetimes. I think the last time I checked, YouTube is having every hour, YouTube gets 550 hours of video uploaded 24/7. So clearly there's a lot of activity going on, but I want to make sure that how can we build sustainable models for these things so that artists get paid, audiences get to find out about the things that organizations are producing, and that those organizations are sustainable in their models and in the way they think through these things. So I think, despite the fact that it's really a tough, punishing time for everyone, I think the crucible of what will come next will be born in this time. And I would love to be part of that fulcrum in moving the sector forward. So, rather than talking about a piece or an essay per se or anything, it's that work and our arts consulting group that I'm working with there. They're some of the greatest thinkers and doers that I've ever come across. So working with these folks has been a really great adventure so far.
And is there a way that people can connect with you if they're interested in talking with you further about this?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've got the Arts Consulting Group has my email, which is mdwarka@artsconsulting.com. And my office line is there, as well as even my cell phone number. All of it's published online. So if you want to pick up the phone and give me a call, I'm available to anyone who wants to speak. But Googling, you'll find my Twitter, my Facebook, I think, is open. My LinkedIn, I have a huge LinkedIn network of over 14,000, I think, connections. And I'm pretty active on all those platforms. So I'm not that hard to find and, usually get back to everyone within a day. So if you're hearing this and would love to just say hi, I'd love to chat.
That's wonderful. And anyone who's listening, all of that information will be in the show notes. So the links will be there so you can connect with Menon. Anything else, Menon, that you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this episode up?
Not anything particular. I just want to say that it's been so great to chat with you, Hillary, and we have known each other for a long time, and it's been a while since we chatted, so I'm really grateful for this opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to have you on and to have this conversation, and the story with John Cage is just, I'm processing that. There's so much richness in that conversation. And I think about how many times people in the arts and artistic endeavors have told me stories where an encounter with somebody who's sort of a luminary figure, if you will, who treats them, excuse me, with compassion, kindness, with that sort of equanimity, has had such a strong and lasting impact, positive impact on their lives in many different ways. And your story reminds me again of how much difference we can make in individual conversations with people. So thank you for sharing that really special story with us too.
Yeah, I'm happy to share it and just really grateful for the opportunity to be here.
Well, thank you. And so everyone who's listening, again, ways to connect with Menon will be in the show notes. And the Arts Consulting Group is the organization that he is working with that he's told us about. And if you'd like to reach Story and Horse, you can reach us at storyandhorse.com. And we're also at Story and Horse on Instagram and Facebook. And Menon, thank you again so much for joining us here today. Really, really appreciate it. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. And I look forward to you listening to the next one. Thanks, Menon. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thanks for being with us today. Please help us spread the word by subscribing and sharing this podcast with friends. We look forward to you joining us for the next episode.